The Guardian.
This is The Guardian at the Edinburgh International Book Festival 2013 with Claire Arnoldstead.
Today's podcast is going to look at translation, and so I have called into our Edinburgh Festival palanquin, where we tend to do our podcast interviews, two people who are very involved with translation. One is Daniel Hahn, who is curating the translated strand of the festival, and the other is Adam Thirlwell, whose new book plays all sorts of games with translation. Adam, tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, it's not, in a sense, strictly my book, in that all I did was I edited this strange anthology, which is called Multiples, and is, I suppose the best way of saying is, it's Chinese whispers for literature. So it's about 12 stories which have each gone through about 5 translations and retranslations by novelists. So the first rule was that only novelists were to be allowed and not proper translators. And the second rule was that in each series, you'd only see the one prior to your own story. So only one person saw the actual original.
So we're going to have a story called Symphony No. 2.
Yes, so this story is by Daniel Harms, the Russian absurdist writer, and it was first translated in this series by Gary Steingart. So this is the normal translation, as it were, although, to be honest, if Daniel Harms read this, he wouldn't be entirely happy already. But this is Gary's version. Anton Mikhailovich went tfu, said ech, went tfu again, said ech again, tfu'd and eched once more and left. And God be with him, I'd rather tell you about Ilya Pavlovich. Ilya Pavlovich was born in 1983 in Petersburg. When he was a little boy, he was brought to Vermont, where he went to the Montessori school in Burlington. Then he worked in some kind of bookstore, then he did something else, and then borders closed. So he emigrated to Canada. And God be with him, I'd rather tell you about Anna Ignatievna. But it's not easy to tell you about Anna Ignatievna. First, I don't know much about her, and second, I just fell off my chair and forgot what I was going to say. Maybe I should just tell you about myself. I'm pretty tall and I'm not dumb. I dress smartly and I don't drink. I don't play Xbox, but I love the ladies. And the ladies love me. They love it when I'm out with them. Serafima Izmailovna repeatedly invited me over to her crib. And Zinaida Yakovlevna also let it be known that she's always ready to do me. Oh, but what I really want to tell you about is this amusing incident that happened with Marina Petrovna. It's kind of an ordinary incident, but amusing nonetheless. Because thanks to me, Marina Petrovna became as bald as the palm of my hand. This is how it happened. I came over to Marina Petrovna and bam, she was bald. That's it.
So then it went through how many degrees of separation from the one we're going to hear next?
Then Gary's version was translated by the French novelist Frédéric Becbédé. And then Chloe Hooper, the Australian novelist, translated Frédéric. And what's amusing is that even only with one iteration in the middle, it's already become kind of amusingly different.
So Daniel, you're going to do the honours, are you? The third version.
It's now called Second Symphony, and this is Chloe Hooper's translation of the translation of the translation. I think I hear the metronome. I'm sure I hear it, and it is speeding up, thrumming like the sound of the cavalry come to set me loose. The hoofs clatter on and on, then turn to footsteps, 1-2, 1-2, as someone comes to deliver my banquet of chaff. Are they coming? I'd prefer we talk of something else. Say, Anne de la Roche-Posay. But talking about her is not a simple matter. For a start, I never actually knew her, and in any case, I have just fallen off my chair. Or rather, if they'd give me a chair, I'd fall off it. And I've forgotten what I was going to say. Am I right in thinking I'd be better at telling you about myself? I am tall enough, and not too stupid. I dress hideously, but then I drink all the time. I have stopped the cocaine, but I can't give up girls. Girls love me. They love it when I talk to them, and love it even more when I permit them to talk to me. Marie de la Rochefoucauld often invited me into her castle, and her little sister let it be understood that she was always ready to be my private dancer. I am still waiting. Oh, but the thing I really want to tell you about is my assignation with Josephine. It is not so serious, in truth, a farce. I went to my cousin's house, first cousin, and very slowly Josephine unpicked her décolletage and its variety of stuffings, and then, from behind the embroidery of her sweetly scented handkerchief, I saw that, really, she should call herself Joseph. And me so hungry.
Of course, a writer like Niccolò Ammaniti depends on translation to reach a wide audience. His latest novel, Let the Games Begin, satirises the literary world and the craziness of Italian society High and Low.
I've wrote another novel that is called The Crossroads, and was a very long period of my life writing a very dark and very sad story. So when I finished, I decided to make something that was more funny for me. And I said, this is the book for me. This is the book that I want to read. When I say the plot to an Italian, said, you are crazy. So with my English, it will be very, very difficult. So I can say that is the story of a very, very important Italian writer. He have difficult to write another book because he have a lot of success and he's very narcissistic. So he's very scared about writing a book that doesn't work. An Italian satanic set that is not very important, so they think that they have to make something very important to be very famous on the internet.
The character Saverio, the leader of the sect, works in his father-in-law's furniture depot. So he's really quite emasculated, isn't he? He's got this very dominant wife.
He lives like a slave with this terrible wife and this terrible people around you, and is like only working. And he found like 2 hours in the night to go and meet the sets in a pizzeria to prepare a very incredible and terrible murder. They arrive all in a huge park that is called Villada, that is in Rome, owned by a very rich man. And in this Villa decide to make the most rich party of the history of Italy.
Basically, it's an oligarch, isn't it, who has taken this park over and made it into a huge wildlife park. But he's a gangster made good. To what extent is this a satire of real Italian society?
Because in Italy we have this very strange situation sometimes, that people that we don't know exactly where they come from became in 2 years very, very rich and very famous. And they decide to show to all the people how they are rich. So they used to have around football, soccer, beautiful models, writers, all the people that they think that with this kind of bodyguards, they are more important. And after 2 or 3 years, and you see on the newspaper all picture of this kind of tycoons, they disappear, and in general they go in jails. So this is the story of one of these.
Now, Fabrizio, I'm interested in, because he, as you said, is a writer and he's a sellout. Now, you are on your fifth novel. You would have started out like Fabrizio, great big idealistic novel. To what extent are you taking, you know, is this a satire of yourself or of your generation?
But I think it's a satire of myself. It's like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I am the good one and Fabrizio Ciba is the bad one. I have horrible sometimes thinkings about life, but I know that are horribles, and I used to put in a box and I said, okay, I don't have to think these terrible things. But I said, why don't make a character that think only this kind of stuff? And he have a lot of success also with a program in TV. So he really don't know if the success is for his book or because for his face, because he's handsome and he's beautiful. And this is something that disturbs Fabrizio.
And what about your literary forebears? I mean, I can't think of anything quite like it, except for maybe something like Ubu Roy.
Important writers, I can say in this moment, I like Tom Wolfe, Christopher Brookmyre. I like very much, it's very funny. I like, in general, people that speak about serious things laughing.
Back now to the pranksters of that translation game, Daniel Hahn and Adam Thirlwell. So you made out of this a cabaret show, which you premiered rather successfully last night at the Spiegel Tent.
Yes, so what we had to do was devise games about translation for an audience of drinking people who were free to leave at any point. And so what we really wanted to do was, in the same spirit of the book, which is trying to say there are many more versions of translation than maybe you'd kind of imagined, we wanted to let the audience explore that a bit. So we did various games involving translating into mime, translating into gibberish. And then our final kind of little game that we did was, we very early on, we discovered that there were something like 20 languages in the audience. And so we sent off a sentence which was the first sentence of Gabriel Garcia Marquez's novel, 100 Years of Solitude.
Many years later, as he faced the firing squad, Colonel Aureliano Buendia was to remember that distant afternoon when his father took him to discover ice. The finale, in fact, is in Norwegian, which we can't read. So this is the one before. This is the one before the Norwegian. Whose job will that be? I recognize the guys here who tried to kill me. Then the thought crosses my mind. It was midday and my dad sent me to fetch water. It was so icy. I remember well, but that's not what's important.
Another author here at Edinburgh also rose to international prominence thanks to a translator. He's the Ukrainian Andrei Kirkov, whose novel Death and the Penguin has become a cult classic, thanks to my old Russian teacher, as it happens. Thereby hangs a tale. He has a new translator for his latest novel, The Gardener from Otchakov. It's another satire, this time of post-Soviet society. And he read a passage to Richard Lee.
As soon as Igor shut the gate behind him and set off towards the bus station, the darkness around him intensified, as though it were attempting to swallow him whole. But his feet kept walking straight ahead, apparently not in need of a sighted guide, and the soles of his leather boots met the concrete surface of the road with reassuring familiarity. Fear crept up on Igor several times, surprising him from behind or from the side. Each time he would stop and look around, trusting his hearing more than his sight, but everything was quiet. After a while, a faint light appeared ahead of him, and this became a reference point. About 20 minutes later, Igor recognized the illuminated gates of the Otchakov wine factory. He stopped under the trees, about 20 meters from the gates, and wondered what was going on. Was it really happening again? Was it going to be like that American film, where the same day repeats itself endlessly, driving the main character insane? Just then the green gates opened. They seemed to be taunting Igor, mocking his apprehensions. He heard the rumbling of an engine, and then the same little old lorry that he'd seen before drove out of the grounds of the wine factory. It turned right and drove away from Igor, lighting up the road with its headlights. The gates closed, and silence gradually seeped back to fill the space illuminated by the powerful factory lights. Strictly speaking, the factory lights illuminated everything on the other side of the concrete fence and the green gates. The square in front of the gates was lit by a street lamp. The gates suddenly creaked again and opened slightly. A lad with a strange sack over his shoulder peeped out of them, just like the day before. Now he's going to come out and wave back at the guard. Then the gates will close and the metal bolt will make a loud clang, thought Igor. Then I'll come out from under these trees and walk over to him, and he'll panic, throw the sack on the ground and ask me not to arrest him. Just as Igor had predicted, the lad waved to the guard, and the bolt made a heavy metallic noise as the gates closed. Igor walked out from under the dark trees and took several decisive and exaggeratedly stern steps towards him. "Oh!" Vanya exclaimed happily, a smile lighting up his face. "Where did you disappear to this morning? I brought you a cup of tea and some sliced sausage for breakfast."
The Gardener from Otchakov starts off as a rural mystery hunt, when a wandering gardener turns up at the house in the village of Irpin, which Igor shares with his mother, with a mysterious tattoo. But things turn strange soon enough. What's the strangeness that descends over Irpin?
Stepan, the gardener, doesn't know anything about his past and doesn't know anything about his father. And Igor notices, actually, one morning that he has a very strange, deformed tattoo on his shoulder. So he asks him what was there
thinking that actually he erased the tattoo because maybe he was in prison or something else. And Stepan answers that he would be happy himself to find out what was on this tattoo, because the tattoo was apparently made when he was 5 years old by his father. Since then, he grew up and skin expanded. And
it's completely unreadable.
Yes, and you have only blue lines and blue dots on the shoulder. And then Igor became very curious, and he decided to try to decipher this tattoo. And he said that, well, why don't I try to take a digital photo and maybe play with this photo in the computer? So, of course, Igor didn't succeed himself, but he had a friend, Kolan, who lives in Kyiv and works in a bank as a computer engineer. And Kolan succeeded. And there was an inscription, Town of Ochakov, 1957, FEMA Chagin's house. Mm. Igor took this printout to Old Gardner. Old Gardner got very excited and decided immediately to go to Ochakov to look for this house and to look for the traces of his father, because he was brought up not by his father, by his aunt and uncle in Odessa.
But they bring back not only kind of valuables, but also this policeman's suit.
Yes, they went there, they found the house, and they found out about this FEMA Chagin, who was apparently friend of his father, and who was a criminal, a very special criminal, who actually hid the stolen goods for the thieves who were imprisoned.
Kind of bank of criminality.
Yes, and then they found the treasure. They found two cases with deposited stolen valuables, and one case with a police uniform from 1957, with a gun, with the leather boots, and lots of Soviet rubles.
Piles and piles of them.
Piles, yes. And grateful, Gardner gives this case with uniform, rubles and gun to Igor as thank you gift for financing the trip to Ochakov, and takes almost everything valuable himself.
But as it turns out, the policeman's uniform is rather special.
Well, it is, apparently, because 2 weeks later, Igor's friend Kolan, who helped to decipher the tattoo, was celebrating his anniversary and invited Igor to a retro party in the club Petrovich, some kind of a retro club in Kyiv. Igor decides to travel in this police uniform to go there because there will be a competition. And he leaves the house. He walks along the street towards the minibus stop, where you can take a minibus to Kyiv. And suddenly the lights are off and he finds himself in the darkness, but the road is there under the feet. And he walks and walks and walks and finds himself in front of Ochakov Wine Factory, where actually he observes this old lorry coming out and then a young man with a very strange sack on the shoulder secretly leaves the premises and he stops him. And obviously this young man is wine thief. And he's afraid of the policeman. Now he thinks that he will be arrested and sent to Gulag because he lives in 1957.
There you go. So he's walked down the road and wound up, you know, in 1957 all of a sudden.
Yes.
Yeah.
And it takes time before Igor realizes actually that this uniform takes him to 1957 Ochakov. But later he understands that he can be there present only as a policeman. And he's quite useless in his real life in 2010. And suddenly, having a uniform, he feels much more useful to the society.
He's a figure of authority.
Much more interesting, yeah. Yes, authority, gun, rubles. He doesn't have a girlfriend in real life. He falls in love with a married lady on the fish market who sells the fish caught by her husband. He gets involved with criminals and lots of other things.
Yeah, lots of very exciting things happen. It seems a very Russian kind of form of time travel. There's no sort of shiny machines and flashing lights and technology. Instead, it's fueled by kind of brandy and nostalgia.
Well, I think it's much more realistic than time machines. I mean, I don't like science fiction. And you don't need to use science fiction if you want to travel in time. I mean, maybe you need more brandy than Igor took.
What you need is a good set of boots and the right direction to travel.
Yes.
I mean, he likes what he sees in the mirror, doesn't he? When he's wearing the uniform.
He sense of his life because, I mean, his life is senses. He's very infantile. He was slightly damaged as a child. Well, I mean, he had a trauma thanks to his father, whom his mother divorced later. So he doesn't work, and his mother doesn't force him to work, and they live off her pension and some savings. I mean, life has no meaning for him, until he starts traveling into the past.
Mm. It's a kind of an affectionate, it's a warm portrait of life in the Soviet Union, this 50s provincial town, where the people seem happier, they're more alive, with eyes that shine with joy, with passion and spirit, unlike the people in contemporary Irpin or Kiev.
The young people don't know anything about Soviet Ukraine. It was not voluntarily, because it is not taught in the schools anymore or in the universities. The Soviet period of Ukrainian history is ignored by education.
It just jumped over.
Yes, jumped over to happy capitalism, which doesn't seem very happy, but joyful at least. The Soviet life was so much despised by the sort of dissidents and people, actually, sort of intelligentsia, that everything was immediately shunned, everything Soviet, including the laws which functioned, the order which existed, the social system which helped the needy. Mm-hmm. And then instead of this, actually, we had independence and no laws functioning, police doing nothing. And if you wanted to get justice done, you would address to mafia.
Mm. Igor says that when he's worried about breaking in, he reassures himself that everyone's breaking the law these days, one way or another. Yeah. It really feels like that. It's the kind of lawless state.
Well, it is lawless state. I mean, and I mean, you if you read the newspapers or websites in Ukraine, you know who among the leaders of the country or among the principals of the universities took yesterday which bribe. So, in fact, I mean, you need to know the history of the country, because otherwise you are detached. And if you are detached from the history of your country, from the recent history, the next result will be you are very easy to lose feeling of your land, of your country. And probably this is why 60% or up to 60% of young people in Ukraine are ready to emigrate abroad.
What are you working on now? What's your latest?
Well, I'm writing a novel which is not set in Ukraine, because I decided to take a holiday from Ukrainian themes, and it's a novel about Lithuanians, young Lithuanians, three couples who are dreaming also about emigration after Lithuania joined already not only European Union but also Schengen zone. And one couple goes to London looking for happiness and success, another to Paris, and one stays behind. Mm. The couple which goes to London ends up in Margate. And the couple which goes to Paris ends up in Nord-Pas-de-Calais, a very depressive region on the border with Belgium. And there is also a sort of philosophical, mystical plot line.
Andrei Kirkov and Niccolo Ammaniti there. And Let the Games Begin is translated by Kylie Doust, The Gardener from Orchakov by Amanda Love Darrah. And that's it till tomorrow, when we'll be talking to novelist David Peace and cricket commentator Jonathan Agnew about sports and literature. It's the end of our first festival week, so do let us know what you think of our podcasts and tell us if there's anything in particular you'd like us to cover. Until tomorrow, from me, Claire Armistead, and my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
The Books Podcast from Guardian.co.uk.